Good afternoon. Welcome to Passionate Internet Voices Talk Radio, Inc., a league of nations among other internet radio stations, voices of the people united we roar. Today is August 3rd, 2007. PIBTR is the internet home for anyone seeking quality information and entertainment, as well as answers to many of the multiple concerns that the average person wants to know. At PIBTR, we not only provide experts passionate about their work, we offer you viable content and solutions. PIBTR is also dedicated to helping publish mid-list and beginning writers, unknown authors, small businesses, and entrepreneurs to further market themselves, their services, books, and products to the media. And now, from 20 of 3 to 320, let me introduce to you, since Dr. Holstein is on vacation for the month, her co-host, Martha Trowbridge, is going to be presenting this program with her guest, Dr. Frank Summers. Good afternoon, Martha, Dr. Summers. How are we doing today?
Good afternoon. I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, good afternoon, Lillian. This is Martha Trowbridge, welcoming all of you to Happiness for Women Only, Dr. Barbara Becker Holstein's weekly e-radio show. As most of you know, Dr. Barbara is a positive psychologist, and creator of The Enchanted Self. Her latest book, The Truth, I'm 10, I'm Smart, and I Know Everything, is hot off the press. It's a lovely summertime read, and you can find it at Amazon and several other places, as well as at Dr. Barbara's website, www.enchantedself.com. Today our guest is Dr. Frank Summers. He's the author of three fabulous books, a supervising and training analyst at the Chicago Institute for Psychoanalysis, and associate professor of psychiatry in the Behavioral Sciences Program at Northwestern University Medical School. Dr. Summers has contributed numerous papers to scientific journals and presents throughout the country on psychoanalytic theory, I think the heat's getting to me today, and the relation of theory to practice. Dr. Summers, how very blessed we are by your presence today.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, you're quite welcome. So as you know, Dr. Summers, Barbara's mission is to help women find happiness. Yet for many of us, try as we might, happiness eludes us. I think that your wonderful metaphor, the unworthy self, may be operative, and today we'll talk a bit about Chapter 7 from your book, Transcending the Self, and how the unworthy self could be at play in our efforts to achieve happiness. But if you would first, could you please, for our audience, define self, what it is, how it forms, and what influences could cause it to deform as unworthy?
Sure, I'd be happy to, and I will try very hard to do that without taking up the rest of the show to answer your question, because that's quite a question. The self, as I define it, is our what I call the organization of our ways of being and relating. Everybody has different patterns of the way they relate to the world and to other people, and the particular way that each of us relates to the world is what I call our self. Now, there are various ways one can experience oneself. Self is obviously very complicated. There aren't any one particular way for any of us that we relate. We do it in a variety of ways. But we also perceive ourselves as relating. So we take ourselves as an object, in a sense. We look at ourselves. We have a view of ourselves. And that can be any of a variety of different ways. It can be positive or negative. And one of the ways it can be negative is what I call the unworthy self. It's a sense of a self that is an organized way of being and relating to others, but there is a sense that I am not worthy, I am not deserving of good things for myself. And often it's not a complete 100%, as you see with Nora, who we're going to discuss, and with most people. There is a sense of trying to burst through and get positive things for oneself, but one finds oneself blocked in getting good things, in being happy. And the reason for that with people with an unworthy self is that underlying what consciously they perceive as a desire for good things, there is a sense of themselves as not deserving, not being a person who really deserves the good things. And so consequently, one sabotages oneself. One mm-hmm. thinks to be pursuing something that would make one feel good and yet can't quite complete it, can't do it in that way, or if one does do it in that way, doesn't feel good about it. And that's because the self is organized around the sense of, I don't deserve that, I shouldn't get that. And that's what has to, in psychotherapy, we work with patients to make that conscious for them.
So is it accurate to say, Dr. Summers, that the sense of unworthiness may be hidden from your consciousness? You may not even know.
I would say it usually is. Now, not always. I mean, there are some people who will say, I just don't have a good opinion of myself, or I don't think I should get good things. But that's more rare. I would say more typically, certainly with the patients I see, they're not aware of what they're doing. I can just give you one brief example of it's not uncommon in my practice to have people who seem to sabotage themselves at the point of success, at the point where they're to get a special degree or a work achievement, and they do something that sabotages what they consciously think they want. And they're not aware that they feel unworthy of getting whatever it is, and therefore they have actually done something unconsciously motivated to undermine themselves. So I'd say more commonly than not, it's hidden from view.
So how would a person, well, this is a show for women, how would a woman explain away or understand steps she takes to self-sabotage?
Well, I think it requires a certain amount of awareness. First, one has to say, be aware that one is sabotaging oneself, that the lack of happiness isn't just some accidental circumstance. There is something that is motivating me speaking in the first person here as the woman, there's something motivating me, even though I don't know what it is. And the more one can become aware that there is something I am in fact doing, that there is a motivation here, the more one has a chance to gain control over that and come to grips with it. If you're not aware of it, it tends to operate outside of your control. So if you ask me what are the steps that one can take, the best way is to say, what is it that is making me not worthy? What is it about me that I feel that I don't deserve good things? And usually what I find with my patients, like the patient Nora that you've asked me to talk about, is that in their childhood experiences, the child will always, and this is true for any child, man, woman, boy, girl, whoever, will always seek the relationship with the parents over anything else. They need that relationship to survive. And if in order to have that relationship, a child has to go along with feeling themselves to be bad in some way, doing things that the parent says are bad, they will believe themselves to be bad in order to sustain that relationship. And so one needs to be aware, usually, of what one is doing that is motivated by an unworthiness and how that came about in one's life to really come to grips with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Nora, who's scintillating embodiment of the struggles of so many women, may I trouble you to read a quote from Chapter 7 of Transcending the Self?
Of course.
Wonderful. Thank you. And this is Dr. Summers describing his impression of Nora when she first came to therapy.
Yes, and I'll say just as a preface, I'm glad you asked me about her because I think in many ways she's representative of so many women, some men too, but more women than men, who seem on the surface to have everything in their favor and yet they can't seem to achieve a level of happiness. Okay, so here's the quote. Nora impressed me immediately as a charming, cheerful, attractive, friendly, healthy-looking, highly agreeable woman who was extremely likable and positive in her outlook and spirit. She seemed to have an active, full life that provided her with a great deal of satisfaction. She loved sailing and yoga, had many friends, and physical health and activity were clearly important to her. In her presence, I could easily imagine that people were drawn to her and would want to befriend her. Despite her statement that her relationship and work presented significant problems, it seemed almost ironic that this apparently happy, satisfied person who had such a quick smile and positive disposition and who had no visible signs of depression or anxiety would seek psychotherapy. As she related her history, her need for therapeutic help became clearer, but there remained a sense throughout the treatment that I was in the presence of an uncommonly empathic and positive spirit.
Well, that just says it all. There are so many women functioning like that, and I will disclose to the audience and to you that I struggled with this very thing myself for many years, where people would meet me and think I was such a high flyer in terms of my accomplishments and so on, but there was something really awry, and it did. I guess that's why I'm so delighted by this chapter of yours, Dr. Summers. I really had been groomed since a very early age to feel unworthy. So could you tell the audience, share with them, please, a bit about what her difficulties were at work and also with her love life?
Yes. She had, at the time she came for psychotherapy, she had already been divorced twice, and she was in the throes of a third relationship.
And how old was she at that point, roughly?
She was roughly in her 40s, I believe. Her children were grown at that point, and she had had children in her early 20s, so she was roughly in her 40s.
Okay.
But vibrant, young, attractive-looking, and like I say, very, very engaging. And so I asked her about, of course, what she came for psychotherapy for, and she said, well, she was kind of troubled by this relationship and not sure what she was going to do. The man she was with was pressuring her to get married, but she'd had two failed marriages, and she thought it might be a good idea to think about what she was going to do, which was a positive for her. But what she told me then about this relationship, when I asked her, of course, about the two previous marriages, and maybe I'll go through them more chronologically, because you'll get a sense of what was going on from the three relationships. As with most people, if you ask for the history of relationships, you get a lot of the history of the person. And what she told me about was her first marriage. She was completely under the domination of this highly successful, hard-charging businessman who she had met in her own position working in a company related to his. And he completely controlled the relationship and their lives from top down. He controlled all the finances. She had no idea how much money they had. He told her what she could spend and what she could not spend. It was more of what she could not spend than what she could. He told her what she could do and what she couldn't do. She wanted to go back to school. He said no, she could not do that. It was had much more of the quality of a parent controlling a child, and a very harsh parent at that, rather than what we would think of as an equal marital relationship. The child rearing was left totally to her. He had no part in the kids' lives. That was just left to her. And she put up with this for years, and probably the first step toward what I would regard as her mental health was that she eventually got out of the marriage. And the way it happened was when the kids got older and she finally really wanted to go back to school because she didn't have that much to do. And she's very smart, by the way, clearly somebody who could be successful academically and educationally. He said no, she couldn't go back to school. And that was finally the last straw. She could not tolerate the suffocation. He paid no attention to her. He insisted that she stay in the house. He insisted that you virtually have no life outside of him, and he didn't give her much of a life. So finally at that point it became unbearable, and she left the relationship. The good news is she left it. The bad news is that it took to that point for her to do it. She then got involved with a second man, and it was a very different kind, on the surface, a different kind of relationship. He was not wealthy. He was a student himself, just struggling to begin to make it. But he refused to pay for anything. The apartment that we were living in was basically falling apart around them, and he wouldn't pay for any of the repairs. He wouldn't pay a cent for anything that might benefit her children. And that marriage lasted 2 years, and she finally got out of that one. But you can begin to see the pattern here. And then the relationship she was in, and this is what was so striking, that she was currently in and thinking of getting married to this man, was of a similar kind of pattern in that he called all the shots, he decided everything they were going to do. But he was from out of town, and either he would visit her or she would visit him, and he was very niggardly with his money, much more like her second husband, and would insist that she pay for all sorts of things and be very niggardly with his own money. And he insisted that they were to get married. She was to come to live in his city. Her hard-earned savings, at that point she had achieved a master's degree and was finally gaining some financial independence. All her hard-earned savings were to belong to both of them. It was a sort of a question of his money was his and her money was his kind of thing. And the striking thing is she said to me in a very matter-of-fact way with very little affect, well, he's a user, as though this was just a fact, like the color of his hair or his eyes. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, made a point of this, of asking her about that. It was almost as though she just expected to be used by people. She expected to be exploited by people. It didn't strike her, really, what she was saying until I, as the psychotherapist, of course, reflected it back to her and pointed out what she was getting herself into. And, of course, the pattern. And once she saw the pattern that she was about to get in, if a marriage to him would have been a repeat in many ways of the first two marriages, then she was able to use the psychotherapy to extricate herself from that relationship.
Mm. Well, good for Nora.
Yeah, that was good for Nora. That was really one of the major steps forward for her. And, of course, in that context, she realized that she had always anticipated that a man would make the decisions for her, and that even though she had gotten out of the first marriage, the easier part was actually the physical separation. And a lot of women find this. When they get out of a bad marriage or a bad relationship or a bad family that's controlling them, the easier part is actually the physical separation. The psychological separation is actually much more difficult because one can then unknowingly get into a very similar relationship that may be a little more disguised, but with the similar expectation that somebody else is going to control them.
How much of that would you say is cultural in the sense that perhaps her mother was taught that culturally and passed it on to her?
Well, definitely in her case, there was a large cultural component because she was brought up in a very close-knit, insular kind of religious community in which one was expected to devote oneself to that community, never move out of it. And her mother basically was a completely joyless woman who did not like laughter, did not like any spontaneity, did not like any expressions of spontaneity or joy or interest in anything. One is supposed to devote oneself to a kind of almost Spartan type of emotional existence. And the only thing that really saved Nora was that her father was not like that. Unfortunately, he was passive, and the mother was the far stronger influence. But he was not that way. He would more encourage her and be more accepting of her natural spontaneity. But, of course, the mother was the more powerful figure. And she also had a grandmother to whom she could go for solace. And the grandmother really encouraged her humor, her spontaneity, the life that was in her. But to answer your question, you can see, based on the kind of religious rationale for this kind of life, that this was a whole culture that she was involved in, as well as the culture of a woman kind of being submissive, which ironically she was taught, even though her father was not really was really more submissive to her mother, but still there was a sense in her life of a religious teaching in which one was taught to be submissive. In her particular background, submission was the way one is supposed to live. And in fact, her sister, there were just two children. Her sister to this day lives close to her mother, never got married, and really devoted herself to her mother only. And that's what Nora was expected to do. Mm-hmm. Now, in a more general cultural context, of course, I think what you're probably getting at is the fact that culturally, women are much more brought up to be pleasers, to go along, to not express their own authenticity, especially if it's aggressive or ambitious in any way. And, of course, she definitely was taught that. But in her case, it was kind of a double layering of that's the role of a woman, but it's also part of the, very austere kind of religious community she was brought up in.
Right. So here's Nora, and she has side-by-side within her that whole cultural, familial imprint of being a good person by behaving in a very restricted way. And next to that is her irrepressible spirit.
Yes.
So she takes steps in her life to honor her spirit. And what happens then? Could we talk a bit about that five-letter word, guilt?
Yes. Well, now you've hit it, because this is exactly the issue. I mean, here is a lady with, as you call it, an irrepressible spirit, okay? A real joie de vivre, enjoying a lot of things, okay? And she did allow herself to enjoy certain things, but always at a price, and the price was guilt. The price was guilt because to be a good person, you were not supposed to enjoy yourself. Mm-hmm. There was always something vaguely wrong with enjoying yourself. But what was even harder for her, that was bad enough. She would let herself enjoy certain things and then feel guilty.
Dr. Summers, could you give us a few examples what she felt she could enjoy versus what she could not?
Well, okay, for example, she loved sailing, and she would go out on sailboats, and she would crew with people, okay? And she loved the sailing, but she always worked harder than anybody else on the crew. She mm-hmm. was always the one who went the extra mile. If somebody else couldn't show up, she would do the work of two people, okay? So there was always this sense of turning it into more of a chore than it needed to be. Okay,
but she did assuage the guilt a bit.
To assuage the guilt, exactly. Mm-hmm. To assuage the guilt, but she did let herself go. Okay, mm-hmm. On the other hand, here was a very bright, educated woman who was working at a position well below what she was capable of. Okay, because she could not allow herself to achieve more than that. She felt way too guilty. She felt unworthy. There always had to be people above her. That was part of this submissive personality that she was brought up in that was still entrapping her at the time that I met her.
So what did you, we haven't talked very much about work, and I know we're limited in time, but mm-hmm. what did she feel guilty about vis-a-vis climbing the corporate ladder? What was the nature?
What she would feel guilty about was that in order to climb the corporate ladder, in order to move up, she would have to display some ambition. She mm-hmm. would have to say, I deserve this. I can do a better job than this person. I can move up. And that would immediately call forth her mother's voice in a very harsh, restrictive way, saying, who do you think you are? Okay? Mm-hmm. Who do you think you are that you can do this? This is not your rightful place. Now, a lot of that was unconscious. We had to do a great deal of psychotherapeutic work to bring that out into her consciousness. But that's what was going on. That voice would always hold her back. She had actually entered at one point a PhD program and did very well. And she said the work was not difficult for her at all. It was easy. But she dropped out after 1 year.
Oh, dear.
She did not know why she dropped out. It wasn't until she was in psychotherapy that I was able to explore with her what was going on. And what was going on is she was getting too close to a position where she would have accorded herself a great deal of respect and a great deal of status. Okay, and that was absolutely intolerable to her. That's where the guilt really, really got triggered and really crippled her in terms of any kind of advancement or any kind of move forward. And, of course, she wanted to be successful. She wanted to exercise her talents. And precisely because she wanted to, she felt all the more guilty for it.
What a painful struggle.
It was a painful struggle throughout her life. And there's actually a little bit more, if I could go on for just a minute. And I find this very commonly with such people. There is an extra layer of guilt that then develops. There's really no way out. Because even to give in to the guilt and cripple yourself and drop out of a PhD program, what that means is you're not exercising your capacities. Mm-hmm. Capacities for enjoyment, intellectual, educational capacities. And whenever you do that, you bury parts of yourself. They don't get developed. And there's a sense of betraying yourself. So there's guilt about that, too. So it makes it even more painful because you can't win either way. Even if you give in to the guilt, you feel guilty about the lack of integrity, the betrayal of who you are.
And there's also a very profound sense of psychic death within you.
Absolutely.
When you do that.
Absolutely. And it's that psychic death, which is a very good way of putting it, that leads to that second layer of guilt that I was talking about. Because you really are, in a sense, committing a crime against yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You're attacking yourself and not allowing yourself to live. And, of course, you feel guilty about that.
Exactly.
So there's no easy way out. Even to give in to the guilt also ironically makes you feel even guiltier for what you're calling the psychic death, for attacking mm-hmm. yourself and betraying yourself in that way.
Well, this book is so eloquently entitled Transcending the Self. Let's imagine Nora asked you for a list of assignments that could help her develop a better sense of worthiness. What would you put on that list? Contemplations, techniques, exercises, and so on, just to perhaps provide our listeners with some something to take away from the show.
Okay. Sure. What I would say to Nora is if you want to help develop a sense of self that's worthier, the first thing you do is ask yourself, at what price are you in your relationships? At what price are you living your life? What is it costing you? So, for example, this guy that she was going to get married to, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about what would the cost be to herself? The cost would be to a very sense of freedom, to everything she had worked for to build up. Okay? So you think about everything you do, every relationship you're in. Okay? what is the cost to me? What am I giving up in myself? What
That's
potential of mine?
Very powerful question.
Yeah, and if you address it, if you address that question, you find yourself shifting the way you're experiencing yourself in the world. You begin to see things differently.
Mm-hmm.
And you begin to see that you're making what I call unconscious contracts or unconscious bargains with the world. Okay, I will get this relationship so I don't feel lonely, but at the cost of my integrity, at the cost of my freedom. And then in therapy we say, or I say to the patient, is it really worth that? And what kind of relationship is this where you have to give up your own integrity?
Okay. So the good news is there are relationships that do not demand those kinds of trade-offs.
That's right. And you might be interested to know, I got a note from Nora a couple of years ago. I had seen her many years ago. And she said, guess what? I finally found a man who treats me the way you always thought I should be treated.
Oh,
isn't that? She
that's
said,
so touching.
I found the man you always told me I would meet, somebody who really loves her for who she is. And there are people out there who will do that.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to ask yourself, you know, a lot of people, as you know, and women especially, feel their biological clock ticking and they're willing to make compromises on their relationships. But you have to ask yourself, how much compromise am I willing to make? What relationship is worth that, and what kind of relationship is it?
Well, it's very hard to not follow your heart. You know, there's so much hype about falling in love and all this, and it can get you into a lot of trouble if you don't use your head as well.
That's right. You know, that's why, Bettelheim in one of his books is called The Informed Heart, you know.
Yes.
Following your heart is great, but your heart has to be informed. There's such a thing as a blind heart and an informed heart. You need both your heart and your head. And if you just go with one or the other, it's very, very difficult to be happy. And along those lines, the other thing I would say in response to your question about techniques is I always ask my patients when they're struggling with a decision like that, you know, an important decision in life, should I take this job, but, you know, what it would cost me if I took it? Should I get married? What would it cost me if I did it? Should I tell my boss something I think is important, but it might cost me something? What I always ask them is this. Which way would you respect yourself more?
Mm-hmm.
That's a technique that I think people can really use, and most of my patients have found very helpful. If you do X, how much will you respect yourself? If you do Y, how much would you respect yourself? Which way would you feel better about yourself? And I think if you use that as more of a guideline, sometimes you can get beyond the immediacy of your heart and get to, well, it will following my heart really make me feel better about myself? Because ultimately, that's what it's about. You want to do the things that will make you feel better as a person, not just something that feels good at the moment.
Right.
And, of course, that's what gets people, not just women, but all people, in so much trouble. They do what feels good at the moment and then feel horrible the next day or the next week or down the line even farther.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Summers, I see we have run out of time so very quickly.
Well, that was quick, yeah.
It sure was. We'd love to have you back sometime.
Well, I would love to come back. Ask me anytime. I'd be happy to. I enjoyed this very much.
Oh, thank you. So did we. We're much more informed for having you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So if you'd like to read more from Dr. Summers, his website is www.franksummersphd.com. where you can find links to his books, or you also may order his books directly from Analytics Press by phoning 1-800-9-BOOKS, B-O-O-K-S, 9. And let's not forget Dr. Barbara Becker-Holstein, who makes this show possible. Her website is www.enchantedself.com and features her latest book, The Truth, I'm 10, I'm Smart, and I Know Everything. Thanks to our producer, Lillian Caldwell, and Passionate Internet Voices Radio. Till next time, I'm Martha Trowbridge. Thanks so very much for listening.
Thank you very much for listening to Passionate Internet Voices Talk Radio. You've just heard Martha Trowbridge with guest Dr. Frank Summers on today's program. I hope you enjoyed it. If you want to hear it, you can listen to it all over again at http://internetvoicesradio.com. If you want a hard copy of today's program, again, go over to http://internetvoicesradio.com. On the left-hand side of the page, you'll find daily info. Click on that. Scroll down until you come to Deb Harris's name. with her email. Copy and paste it and say August 3rd. Happiness for Women Only, Martha Trowbridge, guest Dr. Frank Summers, and I want it, I want it, I want it. And Deb Harris's will take care of you. PIVTR, whether providing you with the advice of experts or giving a voice to the average person who would not otherwise be heard. PIVTR emphasizes quality and enriching programs for our listeners' enjoyment. And before you run away to go out and enjoy the August day, or stay in, stay away from the heat, let me leave you with this thought from Dorothy Thompson. Only when we are no longer afraid do we begin to live in every experience, painful or joyous, to live in gratitude for every moment, to live abundantly. Have a wonderful Friday. See you on Monday, and thank you for listening.